It's a real privilege to be here with you in Cork. I mean, I don't know if you know how far the reputation of O'Vail reaches and how envious we are when we look at what goes on down here. It just presents as one of the most vibrant events for poetry, and the fact that you guys are turning up every week is phenomenal. So, and it's an incredible privilege for me to be here as well. I'm very happy about this. So, thank you for that. I'm going to just start with a poem from home. I'm originally from Enniskillen in County Fermanagh. I'm a McManus. My grandmother was a Maguire, and if you know anything about up there, that kind of locates you absolutely into the gene pool. Perhaps not entirely in a healthy way, but anyway, you didn't hear that from me. But and yesterday was my grandmother's anniversary. No, not yesterday, on the 1st of July was. She died when she was 102. She was cared for at home until the absolute end of her life. And you probably have similar naming rituals for people in this part of the world, but in Fermanagh, because there were so many Maguires, so many McManuses, then you would get an added little bit that would locate you into which part of the tribe you belonged. So she was known as Mary Con Maguire, because her father was Con Maguire. So Mary Con Maguire McManus, as we affectionately refer to her in the house. So she was a phenomenon, and a woman who played Scrabble with the kind of determination of the general going into war, that kind of thing, you know. So this one is for her, and to introduce you a little bit to the gene pool. Mary Con Maguire McManus's kitchen. The way in was down the laundry-lined entry between the houses and through the back door. Depending on what day it was, either she or Mrs. Monaghan, the neighbour woman, had turnabout on the washing line. Any one of a whole series of black cats, all called Minnie and a dead ringer for my grandmother's hat, slid open an eye and checked me out. Max, grey and white and square and wiry and prodigious and polygamous and territorial, made sure I stayed right where I was on the step until she appeared and called him off, if she wasn't gone out already and gone to Cayley. There was always a drop of scald on the go. A small black and white portable television had antennae sprouting from the top, and when she knitted, the picture flickered and changed channel. She had to knit or watch TV. She couldn't do both. She knit the tea cosy and the antimacassars for the chairs, jumpers and sweaters, socks, scarves, hats, mitts, cushion covers, blankets for the missions, squares. Balls of wool hid in bags away from the cat. I had that job to do of holding up my hand so she could wind the skeins and hanks to balls and get on with the busyness of making stuff and knitting the world to rights. Her house had a smell of dinner, or maybe just of thick, meaty gravy and cigarette smokes. She took in lodgers after my grandfather died to help pay the rent and for company, for cards, for Scrabble and standoffs over the word thug. At least one of them was called Neville. She chain smoked for years and stacked up cigarette coupons and green shield stamps to save for things. She smoked Kensitas or Embassy Reds in 20s, but she gave up in her 70s after some bargain with God and a promise she made him if he would grant her some indulgence, some everyday but critical miracle she needed, she would never smoke again, and that for a time the money she didn't spend on cigarettes would go to the missions. The mantelpiece had a clock and palm leaves, a Bridget's cross, mass cards, knickknacks from Canada, rosary beads, memorial cards, candlesticks, and the Sacred Heart looked down on them, and from the hall, Kennedy and the Pope John the 23rd provided backup should there be a need. You must tell Mrs. Hegarty I was asking after her. They always did that, referred to each other as Mrs. Mrs. Cleary, Mrs. Monaghan, Mrs. McClintock, Mrs. Kettles, Mrs. Jones. From the window, even now, there is just grass, a clothesline, and one clump of rhubarb. She has east light. It is bright in the morning. Yeah. Give it up for my nan. The story about the fog was she was playing a game of Scrabble with my uncle and several other people, and she had slid the word fog in, and there was a dispute as to whether or not it was a real word, and she brazened it out by saying, "Indeed, and I was using the word fog when your arse was the size of a shirt button." But it did appear in the dictionary, so she said she'd been sitting there pretending to play it cool and smoking her cigarette very quietly, but she was brazening it out. I'll go to...
Is that in the book?
The story that her arse was the size of a shirt. Or it is, obviously. No, not. Just on the subject of gene pools, she was a Maguire, and the kind of conversations that they would have had would have been, would you be one of them Maguires from the Knox, from Auchinlough, and does that make you one of the Rocks, the Chips, the Stones, the Rurys, the Mickeys, or the Con Maguires? So it's kind of this series of poems are the ones that closed this book, and I have an affliction, and it does make things kind of difficult in readings because a lot of the stuff I write ends up being quite long sequences, but it feels important to read this particular poem. It's called Il Nisharak, the League of the Fools, and it's called after Cliff in Doolin in County Clare, and the poems came when I was between sleep and wakening, and they came in the middle of the night, and I wrote them in the dark. So I was just above sleep, and I had been poking around a lot in mythology and really kind of not making a lot of sense about those things, but I had locked on to this really beautiful story about Dé Danann, where in the war with the Milesians, that the last seven of Dé Danann had gone into a cave near Doolin in Clare, and while they were there they transformed to horses, and they were seen to run off the cliff and dive into the sea. So that for anyone looking at that, they would think that this was an absurd thing. But what it was that they were returning to the fifth province, which was the province of the imagination. And in that space where Dé Danann's part of the toss-up in order to end the war with the Milesians was that they got 50% of Ireland that was underground. So this is kind of relating to that story, and kind of it became a portent for a lot of change that was about to happen in my own life, though I didn't know it then. But the poems came, seven one night, five the next, and like I said, in that time, I wrote them in the dark. So it was really... It has never happened since, and it never happened before. It was a very intense experience of writing, so it feels like they were kind of delivered, that I that my job was to take them down and be committed to just whatever it was that had come. So, Éil na Searraigh, the leap of the foals. This is it, bones, the order of muscle of limbs and bones, conformation. A pelt, colours bay, black, steel grey, dun and the roans, a blue roan and a red strawberry roan, and finally rare and thrown back as if le hinch, the liver chestnut. Bone. I keep returning to a vision of bone and flanks. We have no expectation of wings. That belongs to another time and to some other island. I am trying to recover night vision. I have done as you advised. I have made time. We are gathered in the holding place that is this cave, in need of rest, in need of the dark, in need of concession, giving in permission to be allowed. Half light is bearable. The day is something to retreat from. I wonder how I might create a self that disappears me, and one that will go on stage in my place, sweeping the backyard if necessary, a walking, talking, sunny one, one for the light, one who will buy me time, a worker, so that all along and for a while I can stay in the dark, close to the cool earth, out of the light, in communion, for however long is necessary. I discover what I am become when I see for new the other. I look into your eyes and notice, after stillness and close examination, how far my neck will reach, what has become of my limbs, how I have shifted shape in the cool, in the dark, how I am now ready, restless. Afterwards, no bodies were washed up. What it is they thought they saw is not what happened. What they saw was seven wild and beautiful ones run onto the horizon, run onto the silk scarf laid out by the evening sun. What they saw was the fall. What happened was we leapt. What they saw was rage. What happened was necessary. What they saw was panic, was fear, was running away. What happened was courage. What they saw was heard. What happened was bond. What they saw was end. What happened was continuance, was more, was beginning again, was fate, was faith, was inevitable. They said, horses are not meant for the sea, and missed the part that sea is all horse when it comes to it. Shore, storm, carrying. They said, sea is what separates us, but we know different. Sea is plasma, sea is reach, sea is touch. Sea takes distance and measures it, makes possible. I claim an island for myself, refuge, the marriage of earth and sea, of that which is fixed and that fluid, of that which moves and that which stays put. I am remembering a dream. I am remembering the sea eagle, its leg chained and tethered to the earth. It is for your own good. You cannot survive without being anchored. You are too rare. It does not stop me wanting. I am remembering a glen, a loch, the mountains. I am remembering how far into the distance it is possible to see. I am remembering how high in the air a cliff face, and how perspective can make each everyday thing look toy if you get far enough. This is a poem without end. This is a poem born into a blue day, born into hours walking the shoreline. This is a poem that lay on the rocks imagining. This is a poem with its own songs, its middle distance, its own tomorrow. This is a poem that will pass. This is a poem with its own wine, with longing and with its own truth. This is a poem that has wept. This poem began. Stay in the dark. Don't worry about anything. I have come to work for you. I have shown up ahead of time, dressed for the part, diligent, attentive, conscientious, awake, and in the daytime. Don't worry about anything. I have come to work for you. Stay in the dark. Afterwards, it was the right call. Such things as this deserve their privacy, deserve the dark, so that what happens is not freak show, sideshow, spectacle, or noticed even. Cave becomes womb. Holding does not say nothing goes on, or worse, that nothing changes. Look again. The winds brought 7 early butterflies high up in blue air, a whole 7 of them. Each one made a chrysalis for new and gave it away, and because they knew how, and because this story is for telling, not for show, there were no cameras nor any other record if it comes to it. So in the telling now, because I was there, was part of it, I can tell you this much. What light there was scarce, low, dreamt almost, closer to memory, but adequate, just. Each silk, each folded like a promise, blanket shaped, a promise that would be kept regardless, intimate, but separate. No one really counted time. Each one of us a clock, a life measured in heartbeats, with sleep, with rest, with work to do. Nothing small or belittled, as astonishing as child song, or how a child might lead us to the sea, to found things, a feather, pebbles, weeds, an empty carapace, the knot of something coughed up by a hunting bird, ways of seeing the world. We mistake ourselves for mortals only, and we are mortal, that's for sure. But we are also horse, we are sea, we are eagle, we are stone and shore and island. We are distance, we are bone, and paths that crossed and cross again. Just rearrange the furniture just a tiny little bit here because who knew that hoovering was a extreme sport, but it is, let me tell you. I do tell my husband that one of the sexiest things I've ever seen in my life is a man with a Hoover in his hand. Yeah. In a good way, what it should be. Yeah. Or a mop. Mops are good too.
I want to break free.
Bit like that, yeah. What I realised, it's a long time since I've read that poem, but what I realised was that I can see now too, looking back, that some of the themes that I've been working on in this most recent collection have begun to appear there. The most recent collection is due out in November or something, October, November. And I began to write this work that was really, you just never know where the trigger is going to come from. But for me, I was watching reports on the news about the disappeared, specifically about Joe Linsky, where there was another search for his body on a bog in Louth. And he was probably the first of the disappeared, but he's still not been found, and it was several years before they realised that he was amongst that number. And I was really preoccupied and troubled by it, because I thought, okay, so we know that some people know exactly what happened. And, we don't know, we're not hearing the story from them, but I began to think around, well, that scene, that place, and that perhaps the birds were witnesses, and all of that kind of thing, like a bird told me, and I started to poke around then, thinking about what birds live on bogs, so what kind of birds might there have been. And then again to look at the significance of birds and the meanings attached to them in mythology and their habits. And I like to read a lot of natural history. I like to read a lot of non-fiction stuff as well. And but what happened was, in the search, I discovered this story about augurs and auspices, that in ancient Greece and Rome, there were augurs in the community who were kind of like priests, or they had that sort of role, and that their job was to interpret the will of the gods by watching the flight patterns of birds. And that the will of the gods was augurs. Yeah. And that equally their job was to send messages to the gods on behalf of the people. Romulus and Remus, we were talking about wolves earlier on, Romulus and Remus were famous augurs, and the location, the establishment of Rome was determined by that process of them going out onto the Aventine Hill, the Palatine Hill, and watching the flight patterns of the birds. So what I was doing then was, as I was writing the poems, which are not so much about those ancient things, but it's kind of like really taking a stance that artists, writers, poets, we are augurs. We're contemporary augurs, assimilating a lot of signals and telling society something, at best telling society something about its own self from that process. And anyway, as I was working through developing the poems, I was sharing them with a group of artists of other disciplines, a series of visual artists, a fine art photographer, a composer, a filmmaker, and so on. And we put on a collaborative show on the back of that a couple of times. But actually, for me, it felt like a very empowered thing also to move, for my own poetic practice, to move into collaborating and working with artists in other ways. But also, I had taken a very different approach to researching the poems and beginning to write them as well. So I want to share some of this work with you. Again, it's the last section of the book, really. And the whole section is called Dust. And again, I was working with the choreographer and some dancers, and we were really struggling with all of these contemporary issues around refugees and the incredible shifts that are happening in the world. So this sequence of poems called Dust explores that. One, the heart's graffiti. The living and the dead are gathering to listen and to judge. The distance between them seamless, and we go on loving, looking for gaps in the fences, holes in the walls, the door in the cage left open. Any way to breach frontiers, to live slowly, deeply, so life does not become a shorthand for a firing squad that kills all the small and priceless birds that are the gifts of all that we are not. Listen when a child tells you she can see her own reflection in your eyes. Run your fingers over her cheek, her eyes, her hair, and again down the bridge of her nose to lull her into sleeping. The dark. Don't be afraid of the dark. In war, the dark is on the side of no one but lovers. There they find each other. The struggle is all over. The future is savage, the past beautiful, and the map of today will be revealed only by tomorrow. Uncertainty is our inheritance. Each step makes us more lost, but that's our lot. Don't forget what history knows. Shame can't be cheated. Don't be afraid of not knowing. Decisiveness will stop our questions in their tracks. At the table of the world. Here in this house, unfinished, Spartan, roofless concrete, the earth has set you in its crosshairs. Let me hold you in my gaze. This is the table of the world, and this its cloth. Hold me. Take each corner in your soft, weary hands, and together we will smooth it into place. Each corner, a corner of sadness on the earth in need of the touch of women at their most gentle. Pain finds a home, messages stuffed in pockets, hands heavy with idleness and the work of worry, walls with the face of grief. Our dead stay with us and swaddle us and hold us close like fretful newborns and whisper softly to us in the night, for somehow we will suffer just a little less because of it. Despair has always a heart of some small hope. To each a bowl of water in which to wash our hands, here salt for our wounds, a glass from which to drink. Light a candle for your table. Bring bread. Tell me, where is the blue sky you saw? I will win the sunshine through a window. We share time, life existing in moments, becoming, being. These prayer flies are napkins, tattered and shredded on garlands of barbed wire. Our city is fallen, it is stones, rubble, dust. See here the bullets with their messages, the prisons shattered and reassembled in your bones. Your ribs are window bars that ignore the consequences, refusing to see what time brings. And now this table's cloth is twisted like a winding sheet around the dead. The earth is opening its mouth and swallowing your children while they are gazing at the sky, throwing stones like insults thrown at bullets, like wishes at stars, like hope at hunger. Death replies. Silence. Silence makes rubble of our houses. We are undone. Fact and fiction look and smell the same. Some drink wine and eat veal. Others must wait for the sun, wait for the spring, wait for plants to grow. Words are far too small. Far too small for history, and silence is worse than bullets. worse than bombs, worse than seeing and choosing unbelief. You make your fences higher, wider, longer, and despair has looked you in the eye. Half-truths breed and multiply. Lies are clearing the way for missiles, and truth, dressed in corsets and a scold bridle, walks down the aisle, showered with grim confetti for a wedding to fear. See how the powerful live nervously. See that what passes as a fortress, appearing indestructible, is braced and betrayed by its own trembling. It is makeshift. History brings us messages from the dead, and they are whispering in your ears in the night. Listen. Despair is shoeless, homeless, hungry, angry. It falls exhausted and staggering. It is cold, thirsty, is poison in the water, is hoarding, is filth and prison, is torture, is violence and rage. It is hatred, is obedience, is laws that lip sync, making rules for silence. It trades truth for glamour, cowardice, hygiene and wars without a single body bag. It is cold, so cold all feeling ceases. Indifference. Almost all promises in history are broken. Indifference is the cruelest mutilation. Pity, it has no witness, no grief, no sound. Don't fear grief. Console it as you would a sobbing child, or one so mute with fear it shakes the world. Be kind. Good is without comfort, we know this, but be kind. Choose your voice and choose it well. Your house has no roof, your road is not smooth, and you must carry the chorus in your head, knowing the stories are passwords. You must dream of rest and sleep out in the open, because the powerful fear stories most of all, because all stories are the stories of how the tyrants fall. Chaos is not some worldly untidiness, nor just bad weather, in the same way pain is not an accident. No help will come from somewhere else to save us from ourselves. Put out the search for courage, for wisdom, for meaning, for we have named our children struggle, sorrow, hunger, hatred, tears, blood. Trees are tired with the work of worry. We want to go on living, so no one has to grieve or suffer or lay to waste this heart, these bones. In this strange world, there are scant spoils, revolutions that leave the past to the old. Freedom lives in humble faces and reaches for a hand to hold, so no one dances lonely in the night, so that music changes time. This womb will bear another revolution, and I will name it chaos. For out of chaos comes a dance, a fight for breath. Make a cup for fear. Collect your tears and all the cruel rain, and some night, when the earth is at its darkest, those days of absent moon, put the cup out in the open overnight, underneath the stars. In the morning, run your fingers across the flowers of its prayers and drink from it. A salve for the pain, something for the cure. Repeat as necessary, then go on. Also, just say a lot of the texts that I was reading that informed this poem were texts written by John Berger, who's an astonishing writer, Rebecca Solnit, Carl Sagan, these kind of people really informed the work as well. And yeah, so I need to give them an absolute nod in relation to that too. But thank you. Busting now, I'll find one last one and leave it at that, I think. Maybe this one here is called Unfalling, and this is written after a young US pilot called Joe Pittenger. And I suppose what I was trying to do was kind of get inside of our envy of birds. My envy of birds, you know, it's like they are incredible. They're like little dinosaurs, but they can do all those amazing things, like fly and migrate, and you know, every moment is about that teetering between survival and thriving. You know, they are just so incredibly vulnerable, but they give it all to just surviving. And anyway, to go back to Joe Pittenger, what he was he was the first, so he jumped from 31,000 metres, reaching a speed of 90% of the speed of sound as he fell to earth. Like a starling fledgling in a cage, in a lab, in a bunker somewhere, do you know now, to the marrow of your bones, an itsy, antsy agitation, that perch-hopping fever, that desire to be gone into the unknown? Have you ever launched a bird back into the air from your hands, watched its shadow fade, felt it kick back upon your palms as it rushed up, spreading its wings, as it scoffed at gravity? And were you humbled, envious? Were you dispensable, buccaneer, cavalier, mortal, flirting with life in a game of chance, somewhere between heroics and self-loathing? Did you think of Icarus, hear death calling? Was there one square inch of silence? Talk to me about the weather. Was there trouble in the heavens, the light in tatters? And if instead you'd crossed the Karman line, what then? Meteor, aurora? Was the earth beautiful but irrelevant? And in the thin and nothing of us, nothingness of air, could you doubt the collusion of gravity? Was there a moment when you thought you might never wear out another pair of shoes or put your cheek to the earth? Who kept vigil? Who waited? Did your mother know what you were up to? Who did not dare lift their eyes and look skyward? Whose heart pounded, holding out for news? And when a lover's body replied, soft and yielding to your own, did you let yourself fall then?